The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
You choose a negative yield voluntarily, either if you're stupid, that's one possibility, or if you believe that a liquidity crisis is looming and you want an asset that provides that liquidity in the future. Bonds have some appeal, and maybe the smartest people in the room are moving there. Gold has some appeal, and maybe that's why some of the smartest people are moving into it.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. When I first came to work for your dad back in 1987, I was taught that the central banks, the big government banks, were the largest holders of gold in the world, that they had about a third of the world's gold at the time, and they generally kept about a third of their reserves in gold. Little did I know that the next 20 years, the central banks would be the largest net sellers of gold in the world as well.
If you look at the development of the financial markets from 1987, Kevin, when you began at this company, until now, there's been some very significant changes because you're right. 1987 to about 2009, you had liquidation after liquidation after liquidation. And this is, frankly, after decades, even a century or more of accumulation of gold as a reserve asset. And so there is a telling story here, and I think it's worth reviewing a chart put together by the World Gold Council just to look at graphically how big a deal it is, these changes, this preference for securities during a certain phase. And it really was the popularization of securitized products. And as interest rates were sky high in the 80s and then coming down, there was so many ways to profit in the world of paper assets, whether it was stocks or bonds. But financial instruments were far more compelling in that time frame than this staid asset, this dead asset, this non-interest-bearing asset, gold, just sitting collecting nothing but dust.
Something we've seen throughout history, not just in the last 25 or 30 years or 35 years, is that there has been this tendency to want to be able to create your own wealth out of paper. It's much easier than having to go dig for it, you know, as a scarce item. And so what you'll see, and I would highly recommend our listeners click on this chart, what you'll see is about a 21-year period where the central bank said, hey, finally, we're free from gold. We can go ahead and sell our gold because we're now using securities. And instead, what actually happened was they ended up ruining the very thing that they wanted to replace with gold. We're now at negative interest rates. So they ended up buying all this paper and it's not working. And so what you'll see in this chart, we'll just explain it, is about 21 years of net selling of these reserves of gold from 1987 and 88 to 2009. And then you'll see a dramatic increase of net buying from around 2009 on, especially 2018, more gold was purchased by the central banks than since we've been off the gold standard.
That's right. And it's very probable that 2019 even blows that number away. So here we are, that period of financialization where creativity in finance was paramount and where the advantage went to those who were creating derivative products and insurance products that allowed you to add greater leverage to a financial balance sheet without taking more risk. That was the promise anyway. And again, the divestiture of gold through that period of time, the exchange for financial products, what's really critical is we left that era in 2009. And I think very few investors are aware of just how significant the gold buying has been by central banks from 2009 until the present.
The question we asked last week, what do they know that we don't? If you look, they've known something actually since about 2009. They've reversed, they're actually buying gold, not selling it.
And the focus has been on yield through that earlier period of time, yield as an alternative to gold on central bank balance sheets. Mm. What can we get for the asset that we have here? And can it still be of such a high quality that it can be used as collateral? And yet, can we generate income with it? Perhaps we return to the merits of a central bank holding gold. You know, the new era of benefits of securitized products today really don't outweigh the costs of owning and storing gold. Because as we've discussed perhaps ad nauseum, we are in a period of low to negative interest rates, and that redefines the motivation to look at these structured financial products instead of what served as the ballast, the main support for central bank reserve assets for centuries.
Well, and I think what you'll see also in this chart when you look at it is we the people, the non-central bankers, tend to be possibly in the wrong thing at the wrong time. I think about my career from 1987 till about 2009. Gold really had not done much, but the people were holding gold. Well, the central banks were selling their gold. Then we the people reversed. We now hold paper very confidently. Very few people are owning gold. In fact, the U.S. Mint has talked that the numbers are just about as low as they've ever been for U.S. buyers of coins. Well, isn't it interesting that that's not what the central bankers are doing? The central bankers are buying more gold than they've ever purchased. But we, the people, they've gotten us comfortable, Dave. They've figured out a way to smooth this over with unlimited debt and negative interest rates.
We've had a very eventful week between the much anticipated 25 basis point cut, or what the economists described as the Powell pirouette. I kind of like that. In the market then digesting Powell's comments on being, you know, mid-cycle on the cuts versus at the beginning of an extended rate cutting cycle, which is really what the markets had hoped for. That's what they hoped would be the case. And time will tell if here we are, applying stimulus in the 11th year of an economic recovery.
Well, let's stop and think about
that. Time will tell if that's prudent.
Oh, my gosh. We're in the 11th year of an economic recovery. What that's basically saying is this is the longest period in history without a recession in the United States, and yet we're still applying stimulus. That's what you do when you're at the beginning of a recession.
Yeah. Well, I suspect we all know the answer to this as to whether or not this is prudent. But one of the other significant things this week, if you're looking at interest on excess reserves, when rates were moved lower last week, they also moved the interest on excess reserves lower. They did two significant things. And the QT quantitative tightening, that ended 2 months ahead of schedule. So there'll be no more balance sheet drawdowns. I think that's worthy of note. And also the interest paid on excess reserve was reduced from 2.35 down to 2.1%.
Well, and let's explain that. Okay. These are bankers being paid interest to not loan it to us.
That's right. There's about $1.3 trillion in bank reserves, which has been sitting outside the economy, deposited directly with the Fed. The Fed is paying these commercial entities that 2.35% just to sit on that cash. And this is all a holdover from the global financial crisis where you needed a place to put cash and keep it safe. And it didn't matter that you were earning little to no interest on it. As it turns out, 2.35% is a lot of interest in a world of zero or negative rates elsewhere. And they're just paid to sit and do nothing.
Yeah, do nothing. But what if it starts to do something? What if the dollars start coming into the economy?
That's why I mentioned last week that velocity is on my mind. Because if you incent those dollars to be lent and then spent and recycled, you have domestic inflationary pressures galore. And there's potential for major inflationary surprise. And of course, you've got the fixed income market. If you look at how the fixed income market views the idea of inflation, it doesn't exist. Inflation is the dead horse. The assumption amongst fixed income investors is that no amount of spurring is going to get that horse back up on its feet. No amount is going to get it going again.
Well, now we have tariffs. And the way the Chinese answer a tweet back from Trump is actually just to devalue their currency. Well, talk about inflation galore.
Well, that's right. We had further tariffs announced on Chinese goods at 10% on, it was so funny reading the tweet, a small 10%. That's the way Trump wrote it. But a small 10% on
$300 billion
in goods. And that's by contrast to the 25% on the first $250 billion, which was put in motion a few months ago. And, you know, last but not least on the list of very important things that happened since we were last on the program was the RMB devaluation before the market opened.
That's
Monday
tit for
this
tat.
Week.
Tit for tat. Yep.
So if you look at the Chinese currency, this is by far the biggest news because you're talking about being welcomed to a world of overt currency wars. There have been decades of covert action, which frankly is no less significant. But what we're talking about is the system of a managed peg, the Chinese currency to the U.S. dollar, that coming to a close. You've got them, again, surprising the markets, the Chinese surprising the markets early this week and having to digest the looming possibility of a full-blown RMB devaluation.
This is exactly what Russell Napier told you in June was going to happen, that this was a currency war that could actually lead to other types of war.
Well, that's right. And this is a critical part of our discussion with Russell. Go back to June 4th if you're interested and read the transcript. RMB devaluation, a free float, these were important topics, as were the deflationary impacts of such a move. So you hear us talk about the inflationary impact of certain decisions that are made and the deflationary impacts as well. I'm not meaning to be contradictory here or speak out of both sides of my mouth, but you can have deflationary effects within particular asset classes, while generally speaking, you have an inflationary impact in terms of the monetary system itself. And lest we forget, we were talking about the delinking here of the RMB from the US dollar, the peg, and it's been there for a long time. It's been there for a couple decades. And this issue of undoing the peg is running in a parallel track with continued pressure on the euro. So, and yes, what appears to be a rapidly failing monetary experiment on the continent, these currency issues, both including the RMB dollar exchange rate and the currency issues within the eurozone, these are defining factors for the years ahead. I think they define not only the opportunities ahead, but I think they also will be the defining triggers for the reassessment of liquidity and solvency in many markets around the globe. You change the stability of the underlying unit of account, and as we mentioned last week, there is collateral damage, literally and figuratively.
I think we should look at the collateral damage, because what does a currency war do for a country? What it does is it makes them more competitive. When they devalue their currency, it makes them more competitive in the world market. The problem is, every time you do that, I have to pay more for everything at the store. I have to pay more. I mean, these tariffs are costing money already, but you start competitively devaluing currency. What that means is the dollars in yours and my wallet pay for less and less of real things. So the collateral damage isn't just political. That'll show up, right? We've talked before, if the wallet is thin, politics start to change. That's when rebellion happens. But the collateral damage is just the inflation you're talking about.
Yeah. And it's interesting to me that there is a move at the sort of the lower end of the wage spectrum to make up some of that pressure in terms of a rising cost of goods and services. And I hate to admit, but here I am doing so publicly. I ate at McDonald's last week. And in the back seat, I've got two kids saying, why are we here? You know, they poison their food. And I'm like, actually, that's not true. I might have been slightly hyperbolic last time we drove by McDonald's.
But be careful what you say with your kids.
I know. Yeah. Well, we were desperate for a fast breakfast, and I'm looking at the sign on the window, $12 starting pay. And I thought, well, this defines two things, not only a new wage scale, whether it's the Walmarts or the McDonald's of the world, but it also defines the executive imperative amongst these major corporations to figure out how to reduce staff. So yeah, great on the one hand, but you're going to increase the ranks of the unemployed within a certain social strata. And this is the reality. I mean, I've been involved in discussions with a number of restaurant chains that are looking at how they can process food orders without any interaction with a human being, where you just eliminate that portion
of
staff.
Bring a kiosk in, let it take care of it.
Exactly. Yeah. So from texts to kiosks to apps, but whatever you do, it is a reduction and eliminate. So you want to pay increase? Great. But the number of employees per place, per restaurant or what have you, establishment, is going to be going down.
So that makes me wonder, okay, because politics changes also with economics, the economic soundness of a person. And at this point, is Trump maybe getting more than he has bargained for, or might he get more than he bargained for in this trade conflict? I mean, it's leading to what we're talking about.
And that's certainly something we suggested last week, is there's political implications, major political implications to economic change. And I think you're right. Trump may be getting more than he bargained
for. Well, the stock market's falling too. That's something he's hung his hat on. What if it continues to fall, Dave?
Exactly. So if you continue to put pressure in terms of the trade conflict, but that ends up exaggerating or exacerbating weaknesses within the Chinese financial system, which have a negative sort of domino effect into the financial markets globally, Yeah, there are factors involved which cause the markets to continue to sell off. And now you're talking about real pressure on his election bid. Mm-hmm. So I listen to a variety of news sources, and thus far the Democrats have seized on nothing of substance to derail his effort at another 4 years in office.
Yeah, but what about the eight that Biden thought he served?
I was going to say the debates. We've got another 8 years of Trump, according to Biden. That's good math. Well, the debates this last week, what else did they tell me? Doesn't seem like anybody is on the same team. You've got decorum and civility, which are dead, even among the comrades. And it really did. It reminded me, the last debate last week reminded me of the conflict between Trotsky and Stalin.
You know what makes me so sad? You've got families who are grieving this week about the tragedies that we've seen in the shootings. And yet, immediately, everything became politicized. And I'm talking on both sides, but it was immediately politicized.
Yeah. On the way to the office, again, I do listen to a variety of news sources, and NPR is occasionally one of them. And I learned from NPR that Donald Trump was directly responsible for the mass shootings over the weekend. And I'm watching things in the pre-market and kind of watching what's happening overseas, Chinese currency crossing the Maginot line, receiving no mention at all. This is the news which on Monday tipped the equity markets into a 700-point tizzy.
Right, but nothing was said because we were arguing politics over shootings.
Right. So, and even at the end of the day, on Monday, NPR blocked all market commentary and news of international interest for a rerun of the same interviews with the analysts that were linking Donald, the president, right, to both the Ohio and the Texas shooters. And I'm like, what is going on here? And I admit the quotes from the Oval Office, and I know they were edited to make, you know, the news media's point, NPR's point, they were not flattering comments. In fact, you could just pick and choose any quote from Trump, and it's very rarely going to be flattering.
But is Trump the cause? I mean, let's look at cause and effect on things.
And I said, I think that's the point, is causation, personal choice, specific personal responsibility, you know, insofar as there's violent and deplorable acts which are connected to a body of belief and an ideology. I think what was really weird to me is that NPR neglected to mention the Twitter account of the Dayton shooter, where he's promoting Bernie Sanders, he's promoting Elizabeth Warren, he's pro-Antifa, and he's elevating there was a recent attack of an ICE facility in Tacoma, Washington, and he puts that person in the status of a martyr. And NPR doesn't mention this. It's just a connection between violence and Trump and who Trump is and what he stands for. And I just thought, this is not even good reporting. This is not, there's no conversation to be had here.
Well, let me ask though. I mean, are you really shocked? You're listening to NPR. My wife turns on ABC in the morning so that she can see what's going on. Is the news ever, or has it ever been, objective?
I don't know that news has ever been objective. I don't know that it'll ever be objective. And I always tend to think that it's worse now than it's ever been before. And that's not necessarily the case. When I read through the biography of Alexander Hamilton and I'm reading about the catfights that they'd have in the papers, it was absolutely astonishing. Mm. And I thought, I can't believe that there's such a lack of civility in his age. Maybe this is a human problem and we just need to be more kind to each other. But no, it's not a new issue. And Thomas Jefferson back in the day, you know, looked at the nature of political power, the struggle to get it and keep it. And he said, you know well that government always kept a kind of standing army of news writers who, without regard to the truth or to what should be truth, invented and put into the papers whatever might serve the ministers. This suffices, he said, with the mass of people who have no means of distinguishing the false from the true paragraphs of the newspaper. You know, so whether it's Alexander Hamilton and he's getting dragged through the dirt because of infidelity and a variety of potential misdeeds, or Thomas Jefferson saying, look, truth is not a limiting factor when it comes to reporting. The problem is when we hear something, Kevin, we read something, typically that settles the matter. Bias goes unaccounted for in most instances. And that's bothersome, particularly as we come into an election season.
You know, if you own the method of delivering the medium, okay, as far as TV, radio, whatever, internet, if you actually own the people's interest in that area, you actually can just control the narrative. I mean, if they want to just lead everyone to believe that it's just a white nationalist, It doesn't matter what the news story is. It could be flowers blooming in the spring. It could still lead to white nationalists or whatever you want to call it. And that's the amazing thing. I mean, it's not objectivity that we're even crying for. What we're crying for is to stop forcing a forced narrative.
Right. So looking at the alleged El Paso shooter, The Atlantic wrote an article, which I thought was pretty decent. They had a few interesting things on this particular point. This person's a registered Democrat. He's angry at Democrats and the open border policies. He's very angry and critical of the Republicans' sort of pro-corporate, pro-immigration stance. He actually equated the pro-corporation equals pro-immigration. That was the connection that he made. Don't know how, but that's the connection he made. And, you know, sponsor for, enthusiastic about universal income, universal health care. And in fact, as you kind of put together this composite, he's more of a progressive. But again, I'm listening to NPR and he's been rebranded as a white nationalist.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe he was. Maybe those aren't mutually exclusive categories. But the way he was cast, it was not all that he was. So pull select facts from anyone's biography and you can tell just about any story you want about them. Again, I just, my conclusion early this week, and I know this has nothing to do with the markets and I apologize, but Nietzsche was fond of saying sometimes people don't want to hear the truth because they don't want their illusions destroyed. And I think we're moving into this period of illusions and delusions as we come into the political cycle.
You know, we were talking last night with someone at the restaurant that we meet at, and you know, it's interesting when people, blind rage was the topic last week you brought up during the commentary, that it just doesn't seem like there's any objectivity in the narrative or in the conversation anymore. But you know, if you really look at people, the more fearful they become, the more insecure they become, oftentimes the angrier they become. And the question was by this gentleman who manages the restaurant, he says, what's happening to our nation? What's the heart behind the nation? And actually, it's insecurity, fear, and anger. And of course, it's being promoted by the media as well.
Yeah, I don't know that the rational contingent of the Democratic Party is strategically engaged right now. If they were strategically engaged, they'd be asking questions about the economy. They'd be looking at the markets and they would be saying, they would be pointing, shining a bright light on global economic instability. And isn't that instability being exaggerated by trade tensions? Isn't that instability being exaggerated by the president's non-diplomatic negotiation strategies? And instead, what you find is, you know, somebody like Beto O'Rourke, they're looking at sort of these specious connections between the president and a national tragedy and trying to make it again. It's just, it doesn't even make sense. If you're thinking with a clear head about how to undermine the president, they're not doing it. They're not doing it intelligently. And it's embarrassing logic and analysis. And I think it supports the idea that Frank Herbert described when he said that the recurring problem with governments is that power attracts pathological personalities. Maybe this is the, I can be far too cynical when it comes to politics, but I think truth is a casualty in a democracy that's circling the drain.
I've got a question. Okay. Because we've had bad politicians and actually we've had good politicians. One of the men who we've had on this commentary, a Colorado senator who listens to the commentary, I was sad that Colorado had term limits when he finally term limited out. But I wonder if the election cycle, Dave, is a little too short. I agree that term limits make sense, but you know, it's interesting. Yesterday I was driving downtown Durango and a big semi pulled in front of me and I couldn't figure out what it was pulling because if you ever see carnival rides disassembled, it takes a little while.
Is back in town.
The circus is back in town and I'm like, gosh. Has it been a year?
Is it that time of year again? Well, that's the way the election, that's the way the election cycle feels.
Yeah.
The circus is back in town.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Should the terms be a little bit longer so that we're not continually doing this every 4 years?
It's a good question. And I mean, I am supportive of term limits, but I'm not in favor of the circus coming back through town that often. I'll never forget reading sections of Oliver Sacks' book on neurological disorders.
Right.
Where he passed away this last year, but he documents a group of generally catatonic patients who are triggered back to life and they're full of laughter and animation, but they respond, and it took him a while. I mean, granted, remember, he got his PhD in studying the behavior of earthworms. So he's a guy who's willing to watch for small clues and figure out what it means and what the triggers were. Well, the triggers that he found as he's watching this group of catatonic patients is that they came to life whenever they were exposed to lies.
Somehow they knew.
And there was a cycle of sensitivity to them. They were just this whole group that was being treated for the same thing. They would all, it was almost like an eruption periodically.
I remember that article. They would all just start laughing.
He ended up tying it, Oliver Sacks tied it to the election cycle. Every 2 to 4 years, they would emerge as if from a cocoon.
Huh.
When the
amazing?
Election campaign ads were on and the debates were happening. And then all of a sudden, when all that wrapped up, the results were in. This group of people would go back to sleep for a few more years. Absolutely fascinating.
Isn't it amazing that they would know that? But again, the election cycle. So what we're going to go through at this point is about a year and a half of ads that you wish you did not have to hear, right? I mean, anywhere you go. But okay, so let's go back to the financial side of things.
Maybe the more important issues.
The Treasury just announced, I'm so glad that they told us, that China is now a currency manipulator.
Right.
Good to know.
So they changed the allowance for this flexibility on the peg, and the currency immediately shifts beyond 7 to 1. That is RMB or yuan to the US dollar. So Monday night, within 24 hours, roughly 24 hours, the Treasury Department designates China a currency manipulator. Granted, this peg is arbitrary to begin with. We don't know where the value of the RMB would be if we just let it float like every other currency, right? So they're moving closer to letting it float. And the reality may be that the real market value for the RMB, not supported by the PBOC, the People's Bank of China, is 30 to 40% lower, right? But we're going to say that they're responsible for this move lower. And so we called them a currency manipulator. There are a host of sanctions and options that open up for the Treasury once that official designation is put out there.
Yeah, but what do you do when you've got a tiger that's about to bite? Do you poke him or do you back away? I mean, we have a choice. At this point, do we escalate or do we de-escalate, but we can't stay in between?
This is a family conversation like 5 times a day, not a week. Kids, did you choose to escalate or de-escalate?
Mm.
You know, this did not have to go here, right? Mm. You did not have to be that mean to each other, because back here you were making choices that led to other choices, that led to other choices, and everybody responds in a way that becomes less rational and more emotional as time goes on. This escalation versus de-escalation, those are the choices. We've made the choice to escalate tensions and conflict. I think this is, again, where markets operate off of positive anticipations of the future or negative anticipations. So how do the markets get involved in these currency market machinations and trade policy tit-for-tat back and forth tweets and responses?
Well, do they become fearful and insecure? Okay, that's what we talked about with the politics.
The issue with trade conflict, let alone currency wars, is that markets are put on edge.
There's the insecurity.
And they tend towards negative anticipations of the future. And that's why I would say Trump may get more than he bargained for in the trade conflict. What if he wins the war but loses the Oval Office? Because I'm telling you, he's got to be careful in here, because if the trade and currency war all of a sudden has a negative impact and he can't control the direction of the stock market, which he's hung his hat on as evidence, the best evidence that he, the commander in chief, has delivered the sun, moon, and stars and everything grand to we the people, all of a sudden he's lost his props. And I think the other thing that he's not sensitive to is that these trade conflicts and currency wars can, and if you're a student of history, you know they can and often do morph into something far more bloody.
You know, we had brought up about competitive devaluation leading to inflation, because it is ultimately the destruction of currencies worldwide. But are there pockets of deflation, like you had mentioned before? I mean, where you actually have an incredible slowdown maybe in certain portions of an economy to create recessionary pressure.
Yeah, the global deflationary pressures are definitely growing. Those pressures are magnified by competitive devaluation. You can have the costs of goods going up, and you can have the actual transactions, the number of transactions and the capital flowing either between countries or within a country slow significantly. At the same time, you're dealing with a rise in the price of goods and services. Right now, you've got Trump's, he's crying foul play. And I think it's interesting, because sure, the Treasury got involved in terms of the labeling of the currency manipulation. But his appeal is that the Fed should do something in response, right? So we go after the currency manipulator tag, and that means we get to get nasty with the Chinese, but the Fed is supposed to then level the playing field. What does that mean exactly? Well, we know what that means. It means respond. If you're fighting with a foil, you know, you've got a thrust and a parry, and you've got a back and a forth, and he's asking for a monetary back and forth in this sword play.
It's like a kid who pushes another kid and somebody says, oh yeah, well, I'll push you too. And that's all that's happening is, oh yeah, I'll do the same thing.
And clearly, if you look at the odds of further rate reductions between now and year end, even between now and the end of September, further reduction of rates, what does that do in terms of a knock-on effect? It puts pressure, downward pressure on the dollar. Mm-hmm. And simultaneously, this is great for the president, simultaneously juices the asset markets, boosting stocks and bonds, theoretically, and hopefully, precisely what the president wants. So he's putting pressure on the Fed to get involved. He got what he wanted from the Treasury already, but he's not going out with a Treasury billy club necessarily, not at this point. He really wants the Fed to do the heavy lifting on this, and that helps his election bid.
Okay, but the pressure is also on Chinese leadership. I mean, what are they going to do to control their narrative?
RMB passes 7-1 on the exchange rate, and it's significant. We mentioned Baosheng, and we mentioned the series of defaults and the need for intervention within the financial markets last week. We've had, I would say, dozens of other financial institutions in China come under pressure since our conversation last week. And again, some of them are small enough, it doesn't matter, but it's billions, not hundreds of billions or trillions, so it doesn't make the radar in terms of real risk. And what I'm saying is there is an accumulation of problems in China. And the two distractions that I could foresee the government there employing that you could use to sort of draw attention away from either currency depreciation or financial market concerns. The Chinese are well aware of the risks they face in the financial markets and within the economy. And their step sequence for dealing with conflict and issues on the street, this is where I think you've got two ways to sort of rally an unhappy populace should you see domestic sentiment sour further. Number one, you've got distraction. The Hong Kong issues and the protests that are there in recent days, they've turned violent. And who knows to what degree that's the people on the street turning violent or the stage being set for the PLA. Mm-hmm. And the incursion by the PLA from the mainland, that's the People's Liberation Army, for the Chinese army to get involved at this point, it's very likely, actually, after the violence that's been on the streets in recent days. But what is that really? It's a convenient distraction. It's a convenient distraction from a deteriorating financial and economic situation, which, you know, if you're looking at the price of soy and rice and things that would be needed to feed either livestock or people, they've got issues of social stability that hang over their heads all the time. The second thing I'd say that would serve as a distraction, and this is a bigger issue and probably lower probability, is military action taken against Taiwan. So the first looks like police action to control dissidents. Right? That's pretty straightforward. It's tough for us to get involved. In part, who are we to criticize a militarized response to protests? If you've checked, our police force is pretty well militarized as it is. You don't need the National Guard. If you see the local sheriff's department or police department show up on scene to control a crowd, they're indistinguishable from the Marines. So where do we criticize the PLA from getting involved in Hong Kong? But the second would trigger military conflict between two superpowers.
So do you think that's likely?
The first seems higher probability, but both serve to redirect domestic attention, that is Chinese attention, away from a deteriorating financial market situation. And again, it's this direct economic impact that's so important because here we are, 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China, also coincides with the 30th anniversary of the protests in Tiananmen Square this year.
I remember that. We had a television in the trade room back in the Denver office before we moved down here. And I'll never forget that, you know, that iconic scene that we've never forgotten of the man standing in front of the tank in Tiananmen. And that was 1989.
That's right, 1989, 30 years ago. And so that there's, you know, which is the narrative that the Chinese Communist Party wants to promote? I don't think there's going to be a tank man in Hong Kong, but there may very well be a PLA crackdown on the Hong Kong demonstrators. And I think Xi wants to control the narrative. This is the year to celebrate. This is not the year to commiserate.
You know, my son showed me something on YouTube that just shows how things have changed in 30 years, too. With all the surveillance in China, he showed me a video of how people who were there in Hong Kong who were protesting, they had lasers, and they were shining these lasers on the various cameras in the area that they were protesting. So you could see all these. It was actually a very colorful video. But it's because everybody was pointing lasers at these cameras, because we now live in an age. This wasn't 30 years ago. That man standing in front of the tank could not be identified within seconds on a computer program based on cameras. Now he can be. Every one of those protesters can be identified by the software and the hardware that's been put in place in China.
I remember sitting on a plane. Sometimes you run into the most fascinating people when you're traveling. And I remember sitting on a plane. I don't know if it was 6 years ago, 8 years ago. It's time goes by so quickly. It could have been that long. And we introduced ourselves, and he said he was an engineer with Google and that he was working on a technology for them. I said, what kind of technology? He said, facial recognition software.
For China. He was working on that.
No, this
for China.
Is for Google.
Oh, for Google.
For Google.
Okay.
No. And he looked at it as a very innocuous improvement to technology. Mm. And I just have a hard time thinking about the benign effects of that kind of information. In Hong Kong, every one of those protesters is a marked person if right. they've been on camera. They've been identified. Their whole families have been identified. There's a dossier. There's a file. And it's a very complex world when you have data accumulation, identification, no real recognition of the value of anonymity or privacy.
Well, and you're scored. You're scored by how politically, you know, close you play the game to what the Communist Party wants.
And I think we're going to find ourselves at sort of a social jumping off point where no one has valued privacy for a long time.
Right.
No one has valued anonymity, the right to be forgotten, if you will. And no one's really put that as a priority. But I think we're going to discover why it's a priority, and maybe the Chinese will teach us a thing or two on why it makes sense to keep a lower profile.
You told me that you were up till 2:30 in the morning last week with one of our guests who specializes in this. In fact, he's a guest that told us if we get something free on the internet, we are the product. He says, get used to it.
Becker Polverini.
Yeah.
A really neat guy. And yeah, we got to brainstorm a little bit more on a few privacy issues and some of the technological challenges as a hacker and as someone who is brought on by corporations and even governments to figure out how to protect against attacks.
Well, he has to hack to learn how to protect against hacking. We can't even name the people he does know how to hack.
No, but it's interesting because I'm just left with this impression that today no one cares about privacy and anonymity. And tomorrow, everyone will.
Until you have to hold a laser at a camera to be able to speak your piece.
And so I wonder if we're not at that similar inflection point where the central banks have already recognized a significant shift, a move from the world of financial assets where it doesn't matter if anyone knows that you own it, the benefits to ownership speak for themselves.
Right.
And they've already made the transition back towards an asset which is just kind of boring, collects dust and hardly anything else. And so that issue of gold being central to the way that central planners position their reserves, wouldn't it be interesting if we're also entering into the same period of time where individual investors are discovering that they actually do need a part of their wealth, which is private, which is portable, which is unknown to most people. And again, it's a mindset shift because if you ask the average millennial or even Gen X person today what they would do with an ounce of gold, let alone 10 or 100 or 1,000, they just kind of shake their heads. Like, why would you bother with that? And it's important for us to keep in mind that the traffic into gold is happening at the same time you're seeing traffic into the bond market. And there may be a very important messaging. You and I have talked and maybe even minimized the importance of the messaging in the bond market because the footprint of central bankers into the bond market is a massive one. But we continue to see new record lows in terms of yields around the world. Now $14.1 trillion in negatively yielding paper.
Negative paper. That is amazing.
And I know that's part of the central bank edict, lowering rates. I know that's a part of the central bank footprint, their purchases. And a part of it is also investor traffic into those bonds. If you combine the impact of Chinese devaluation, the end of the euro as a monetary unit, and what that leads to in terms of global financial stability or instability, those concerns, we're right back to this very dangerous two-step of liquidity and solvency. We saw it in 2007, 8, and 9. You choose a negative yield. If you're an investor, why would you do that? Why would you be a part of that fray, the investor alongside the central banker? Why would you move into bonds with a negative yield? You choose a negative yield voluntarily, either if you're stupid, that's one possibility, or if you believe that a liquidity crisis is looming and you want an asset that provides that liquidity in the future. Now we're full circle to where we began the conversation. Bonds have some appeal. And maybe the smartest people in the room are moving there. Gold has some appeal, and maybe that's why some of the smartest people are moving into it.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or you can give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.